It's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Laura Sullivan.
What we can confirm now that Saif al-Gaddafi has been arrested and he should be tried in front of the Libyan court by Libyan people and by Libyan justice.
That's Mahmoud Shahmam, Libya's National Transitional Council's information minister, announcing that Muammar Gaddafi's son, Saif al-Islam, had been captured. The U.S. State Department hasn't confirmed it yet. James Fallows of The Atlantic joins us, as he does most Saturdays, for a look behind the headlines. Hello, Jim.
Hello, Laura.
The images of his father's bloody capture are still so fresh in our minds, and the new Libyan government came under a lot of international fire for that. How should they proceed with this latest news?
Well, obviously, they need to handle the son in a much different way from what happened to the father. The transition from dictatorship or autocracy or whatever comes before a democratic system to whatever comes afterwards is always difficult. We saw that in Eastern Europe with the fall of the communist bloc countries. We saw that certainly in Iraq, and we're seeing it in Afghanistan. So I think this will be an important test for whatever is the new regime in Libya to see whether they're able to handle this fraught situation in a more orderly way.
In other foreign news, President Obama ended his 9-day trip to Asia's Pacific Rim. And the big announcement, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton will visit Burma, now known as Myanmar, next month. Myanmar's been right up there with North Korea in terms of isolationism. So this seems pretty surprising.
And the United States and most Western powers have maintained a boycott against the Burmese regime because of its cruelty, its isolation, its long-term imprisonment of the Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi, etc. But in the last really couple of months and couple of weeks, there have been signs from the Burmese leaders that they're willing to have a more open policy, which is partly perhaps some democratic revival or kindling in Burma, but also a sense that in the absence of the U.S. and all their Western powers, really the only country that has dealt with them has been China. And so Burma has been more and more in the situation of becoming a sort of quasi-Chinese protectorate or vassal state. And so that's one other aspect of this possible opening to the West.
How did the Chinese view his trip?
There's been a fair amount of consternation in the Chinese press in the last couple of days, especially about the announcement in Australia that the United States would position for the first time in a very long while a U.S. Marine Corps base in northern Australia in Darwin, which is a point so far north in Australia that it's right next to Indonesia. And this is part of a larger orchestration over the last year or year and a half of the U.S. signaling in various ways, visits by Secretary of State Clinton, by Secretary of Defense Gates, to all the countries except China. China, showing that the United States is not going away as a Pacific power. Its economic problems don't mean that it's going to retreat entirely into a North American shell. And simultaneously, the Obama administration has been reassuring the Chinese that we're not threatened by their rise. We don't want to contain them. But it's been quite, I think, an artful balancing act of showing that we want to maintain our presence in the Pacific, both militarily, diplomatically, and economically in the long run.
Well, Obama's headed back to Washington tonight, and here in Washington, the Congressional Supercommittee is still trying to find common ground on budget cuts and revenue increases. And the deadline for them to send their proposal to Congress and get it approved is Wednesday.
If the Supercommittee doesn't make a deal, as almost no one thinks it can, nothing really is going to happen in the short run. The first automatic cuts to the budget, which would be equally divided between defense and non-defense spending, won't happen until early 2013. That is more than a year from now and after the next presidential election. And if you know anything about politics in the Congress, lots of adjustments are possible between now and then. I think the main point this raises is that the disagreements about whether taxes can and should be increased, about where and how spending can be cut, they weren't resolved in this committee, and they will be debated as the main issue of the presidential campaign in the year to come.
James Fallows is national correspondent with The Atlantic, and you can read his blog at jamesfallows.theatlantic.com. Jim, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Laura.
A bunch of the boys were hooping it up at the Malamute Saloon. The kid that handles the music box was hitting a ragtime tune. In front of the bar in a solo game sat Dangerous Dan McGrew, and watching his luck with his light of love, the lady that's known as Lou.
That's the voice of Kurt Vonnegut reciting a poem he learned almost 70 years earlier as a child in Indianapolis. Author Charles Shields made the recording while researching a biography of Vonnegut. It was March 14, 2007, and later that day, Vonnegut tripped and fell down the steps of his New York brownstone. He hit his head and lapsed instantly into a coma, and he died. Charles Shields spent hours talking to Vonnegut in that last year of his life, and he had extensive access to the man's letters and papers, and he's compiled it all into a new biography, And So It Goes, Kurt Vonnegut, A Life. Charles Shields joins me now from member station WVTF in Charlottesville, Virginia. Welcome to the show, Charles.
Thank you for having me.
You write that one of the first things that you noticed when you sat down to speak to him was how bitter he still was at his relationship with his parents and his brother. What was it that he was holding on to all of these years?
Well, my theory is that Kurt had a lot of residual pain from his childhood. And when you pile that on top of his experience in World War II, he was in Dresden when it was bombed and saw a city annihilated. When you combine those two things, my impression of Kurt Vonnegut at 84 was that he was a very pained and haunted man. And I was, as you say, surprised when I first started talking to him that he began complaining about his parents. For all the world, I thought I was talking to a much younger person who still had a real beef with the way he had been raised. But, you know, I think that's probably part of Kurt's appeal to young people is that when they open one of his novels, they get the sense that an older person is leveling with them, that someone appreciates the dilemmas that they're feeling.
Slaughterhouse-Five, of course, was his greatest work. And, well, I guess that's debatable, but it's his most famous work. And he really struggled to write it. I mean, it took him 20 years. He started and stopped and started again. And it seems like the biggest problem he had was this idea that he didn't actually see the bombing of Dresden, that he was just in the basement. He saw the before and the after.
You're absolutely right. The problem that he was facing was he had no act two. He had an act one and he had an act three. Kurt realized he had an important story to tell, a moment in civilization, and he was there for it, almost like the sacking of Troy. But he missed the sacking of Troy. He was as if he had, you know, arrived, slept through it, and then left again. What he did, finally, the solution he hit upon was not to be constrained by time or chronology. If he was going to tell his story for Slaughterhouse-Five, he couldn't tell it in a linear way. He needed Billy Pilgrim, his main character, to ricochet around through the universe, doing different things and being in different places at different times.
One of the things in the book that is so fascinating to me is that while Vonnegut was considered this icon of the counterculture movement, I mean, it almost seems like he was faking it.
Well, you know, he did work for General Electric in public relations, and he had a pretty good idea about how to pitch an idea and how to create an image. I don't mean to persuade anybody that Kurt was a cynic, just the opposite. He read the signs of what was happening in the country, and he realized that he was going to have to be a lot hipper than a nearly 50-year-old dad in a rumpled cardigan to be a good match with what he was writing about. So he, just as, you know, Samuel Clemens was doing Mark Twain, Kurt Vonnegut began to do Kurt Vonnegut. And it was a big hit. But, you know, the irony, when you really study Kurt's novels and when you look at the things that he said and also my interviews with him, Kurt was not really so much a radical as a reactionary. Mm-hmm. What Kurt wanted was an earlier America. He wanted an America that he remembered before World War II, an America of aunts and uncles and swimming holes and things like that. That was the world he wanted to return to. I think a seminal moment that shows the contrast between what people thought of Kurt and what he was actually like was this. Jefferson Airplane asked him if he'd like to brainstorm with them for their next album. So he went to the meeting with Jefferson Airplane wearing a Brooks Brothers suit and wingtip shoes.
I'm speaking with Charles Shields. His new book is And So It Goes, Kurt Vonnegut, A Life. It seems like that there is this disconnect that runs throughout the book about the way Kurt Vonnegut sees himself and the way the people around him saw him.
Yes, I think one of his nephews said that Kurt seemed a whole lot hipper than he really was. I mean, here he is being read by hippies and counterculture types, and, you know, he's still being read. I don't mean to say that his work is time-specific either, but it's true. In the biography, I show a man who was a little bit surly to his kids, who was obsessed with doing his writing, who wanted to make it big, and was perceived by his public as somebody who was the ideal, avuncular, jocular kind of person, you know, somebody who tells it like it is and somebody who will level with you. Well, Kurt was actually rather flinty, rather irascible. He had something of a temper, but as I also point out in the book, he was a damaged person.
How do you reconcile these two people? I mean, the man who wrote, "God damn it, babies, you've got to be kind," and this other guy who had difficult relationships, sometimes was not so great to his agents and publishers, and was a little bit irascible.
Kurt was a disenchanted American. He believed in America. He believed in its ideals. And what he wrote in his books was a kind of an outpouring of his disenchantment. He wanted babies to enter a world where they could be treated well, and he wanted to emphasize that people should be kind to one another. So these were his priorities as a human being. But as, you know, so often happens in life, he had a sort of a creative professional side and a personal side. One fed into the other. As one reviewer said recently, you know, Vonnegut couldn't have been the kind of writer that he was unless he was this kind of person. And so I don't see it as a complete break. I see his pain as, you know, pouring into his works in a kind of a wry, droll, unhappy way.
Charles J. Shields is the author of And So It Goes, Kurt Vonnegut, A Life. Charles, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you very much.
From NPR News, it's Weekends on All Things Considered. I'm Laura Sullivan, in for Guy Raz. In 1990, a fire broke out in a house in Jacksonville, Florida. Two women and four children died. The husband of one of the women became the prime suspect. Everyone thought it was arson. That's when a fire investigator named John Lentini was called in.
So I met with the captain and I looked at his evidence, and it looked like what passed for good arson evidence in those days.
Lentini looked for V marks on the walls to see where the fire started.
Shiny alligator blisters on the floor were a sign of accelerant.
He calculated it would take about 20 minutes for the house to become engulfed, something experts call flashover. Plenty of time for the husband to set the fire. All the while, though, the husband claimed his innocence. Then, almost on a whim, Lentini noticed an identical house two doors down that was slated to be demolished.
So what else could we do but burn it down? So we refurbished the house, and then we lit it on fire. Well, after 4 minutes, we had flashover in that room. And, you know, I was pretty shocked. I thought, oh, my gosh, this might not really be a set fire.
And it wasn't. They dropped the charges against the husband, and it was a seminal moment for Lentini.
What I knew about arson, some of it was wrong. And what a lot of people thought they knew about arson was wrong.
That's our cover story today, the changing science of fire investigations and how what may once have been considered science wasn't, in fact, science at all.
The only science that anybody thought about was the science that happened in the laboratory when chemists would look for gasoline on the living room rug. The rest of it was art.
Where did all of these old ideas of how fires started come from?
Anecdotal experience. I mean, nobody ever set out to send an innocent person to jail. But if somebody would see an artifact and then find gasoline, they would make a connection. And then the next time they see that artifact, they just assume that gasoline must have caused it.
Do you think that means that innocent people have gone to prison?
Oh, absolutely.
The few months of research I did on this turned up at least two dozen cases.
That's Doug Starr. He's the co-director of Boston University's Center for Science and Medical Journalism. And he recently wrote an article for Discover Magazine examining arson cases that relied on now widely debunked theories about how fires start.
One of the earliest cases was a 16-year-old named Lewis Taylor. He was convicted of setting the infamous 1970 Pioneer Hotel fire in Tucson. He was convicted on 28 murder counts based on the then fire investigator's observation that at opposite ends of a hall, there were severe areas of burn. At the time, it was thought that the area of the deepest burn must be where the fire started because it burned there the longest. And working backwards from that evidence, they figured that because they found Taylor with several matches in his pocket, He must have set those two fires, and they must have been set independently. Last year, at the behest of an attorney, several fire investigators looked back at the evidence, and they said this looked like a classic accidental flashover fire, which you do get deep burn areas in separate areas, not because they were set, but because that's what ventilation sometimes does. But Taylor is still in jail.
Really?
Yeah, the Arizona Justice Project is trying to get the case brought up, but these cases are extremely hard to get re-reviewed.
How many cases do you think are there out there?
The investigators I speak to say that there may be hundreds out there. For example, you all know about the Willingham case in Texas, in which Cameron Todd Willingham was executed for, you know, burning a house and killing his children. The Texas Forensic Science Commission, in reviewing that, found that that was not a good decision. And just at the end of October, they said that all cases in Texas have to review. We're talking about between 750 and 900 arson cases in Texas alone.
Have you noticed any common threads?
Yes. First of all, it must be said that everybody means well. Everybody's doing the best that they could do. But for generations, fire investigations have been based on kind of folklore, apprentice-type knowledge, in which a fireman may be consigned to the investigative unit, and he or she will learn classic signs of arson from the person who came before. The trouble is, this was all based on observation and intuition, and science needs something more than that. And fortunately, the new forms of investigation that are emerging are based on actual laboratory science in which things are demonstrated to be true or not true.
What are some of the new techniques that are being used now?
It's really interesting. Scientists are analyzing smoke detectors. It turns out that when a smoke detector goes off, you know that high-pitched siren sound it makes? That causes a kind of sound vibration that causes tiny particles to accumulate in particular patterns around the sounding horns. So by analyzing that, they could get a better idea for how long a smoke detector was going on or if it went off. So this is all science. It's been quantified in the laboratory. People can attach numbers to it. It is outlined in professional standards. And given time and money, people can analyze a fire pretty well nowadays.
Some of that newest research on how fires start and spread is now coming from ATF. The federal agency's always done a little fire research, but it went all in 2003 with a new lab in Beltsville, Maryland, built just to burn things up.
He's measuring out the diesel fuel now into our little graduated cylinders here.
Jamie Lord is one of ATF's fire research engineers.
You put a little gasoline in there, Jamie?
Yep.
Yeah, he spiked it with a little gasoline. So if you poured diesel into a pan and tried to light it with just a match or a lighter, you'd be there all day.
ATF runs these experiments all day long to study heat, combustion, burn times.
Yeah.
Really a lot of smoke for just a small pan.
Yeah.
The researchers say they're pretty used to smelling like they're at a never-ending barbecue. John Allen is the chief of fire research here, and he gave us a tour.
This is a very large room. This is like an airplane hangar.
This is the largest forensic investigative tool in the world.
And I have to say, this is the largest upside-down cone I have ever seen in my life.
Well, basically, this is a 40 by 40 foot inverted cone over our head, which, when we set a fire here, acts to pull that smoke out of the room and the heat to measure carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, and things of that nature. And what you see here is actually a quarter-scale model of a room.
It's a living room.
It's a living room with a couch, a couple of chairs, a TV set on a small bookcase, and a crib with a few stuffed toys in there. As we set a fire in this room, what will happen is the fire will begin to grow. Cool air comes in from the bottom. The hot air and hot gases will start escaping out of the top. As the fire gets bigger, more and more heat will start pooling at the ceiling, and fire will start extending out, but then the heat radiating down from all that burning gas above will start catching everything in the room on fire, which is a transition phase that we call flashover, which is essentially going from a fire in a room to a room on fire. Once you go into a flashover stage, all the original patterns and things like that on the wall can now be changed and obliterated. You can't walk in and look at the scene and say, well, I know the fire started here because of this damage, because no, the whole room was so severely damaged that you have to do much more processing.
Is that different from the way fire was understood 10, 20, 30 years ago? Do you think it's made sort of leaps and bounds in the past 10 years?
I would say because of the presence of this laboratory, yes, there has been advances in scientific knowledge. For an example, If I take a cigarette and throw it in gasoline, it'll go out.
Oh, but
we've
they
done
have it in all the movies.
That's TV. That's exactly right. That's the CSI
that's
effect
how
of
that's
TV.
That's how you make a gas tank blow up,
and I'm sorry,
right?
I'm going to dispel that myth, but we have done thousands and thousands of tests with cigarettes in gasoline to try and get cigarette to ignite gasoline. We have not been successful yet. But I didn't say it's impossible, so don't try it.
Yeah.
Because you may be the one that actually finds that, hey, I did get it to happen.
What do you think are some of the other great myths that you've dispelled in this lab?
The couple of old ones, spalling of concrete.
What is spalling of concrete? If you look
at a concrete floor after a fire and you see chunks and slabs all broken up across the concrete, well, that was an indication that somebody poured gasoline on there.
Oh.
No, that just means there was moisture in the concrete. And we all know now that myth from 40 years ago is not true.
Next to the living room is another structure, an almost completely finished trailer. John Allen says this is the other half of what ATF does now. It recreates fires to help local investigators with actual cases where arson is suspected. In a few days, they're going to burn this trailer down.
This used to be the combination kitchen area and living room area where there was a couch. We had a mock-up refrigerator. We actually go out to wherever we can to find the materials like the couches and things like that to bring them in here and set the fire up. Some cases, like this room, was not actually involved in the fire, but because the smoke and the heat progressed through the trailer, then we have to build all those different areas to include them in there to mimic what was really there. And we have our crew assembled with all the materials we need here to quickly put things together and to answer those specific questions that may come up. Again, we're not the actual fire investigators. We're the engineers and scientists that support.
Do you ever get tired of building things that you're just going to burn down?
I couldn't think of a more fun job in the world to be able to come in, and every day we're doing something new and different. And many days it's something cutting edge that's never been done before.
This year alone, this lab has recreated fires from 3 murder cases. In all of them, prosecutors ended up dropping the charges against the suspects because the lab determined that what officials thought might have happened when the fire started actually didn't.